Hello, and welcome to More or Less, your weekly guide to the numbers all around us, in the news and in life. This week, we pick apart a claim that Brexit has already cost more than all of the UK's net contributions to the EU, right back to the 1970s. We also ask whether Liverpool Football Club is just lucky, and critically, whether I could outrun an angry alligator. But first.
Yamaha has sounded a note of caution against musicians climbing into their instrument cases, warning that it could lead to a tragic accident. A number of people in Japan appear to have mimicked the method used allegedly by the fugitive former Nissan boss Carlos Ghosn to flee the country. Yamaha pointed to people pictured in harp and double bass cases and urged, "Please use them correctly."
Ghosn himself told a press conference in Lebanon,
"I did not escape justice. I fled injustice."
Japanese Justice Minister Masako Mori rejected that idea.
"He has been propagating both within Japan and internationally false information on Japan's legal system and its practice. This is absolutely intolerable."
Loyal listener Tim Marsden sent a question to us via moreorless@bbc.co.uk.
Carlos Ghosn claimed that the conviction rate in Japan was 99%. Can this be right? I always thought that only authoritarian regimes like China had those kind of rates. Looking at a Wikipedia page on conviction rates, it seems that the conviction rate in Canada is 97%. I find the numbers for Japan and Canada very puzzling.
Well, let's ask Canada to politely wait its turn and start with Japan. Colin Jones, a professor at Doshisha Law School in Kyoto, is co-author of a new book called The Japanese Legal System. I asked him, is the Japanese conviction rate really 99%?
Yeah, actually it's higher. It's commonly described as being 99.9%. I think it's closer to 99.4%, depending on what you're looking at. But yeah, it's very high.
It could mean various things. It could mean that the courts are basically corrupt. It's a police state. Nobody gets a fair trial. Everybody is automatically locked up. Or it could mean that the innocent are removed from the process at some earlier stage before the court. It's not the jury or the judge. It's some other procedure. What is your sense of what explains this, what seems to be a very high conviction rate in Japan? What is it about the system that produces that?
The prosecutors have tremendous powers to ensure that people give the testimony that they want, the confession they want, through this system of prolonged detention and investigation before bringing charges. They have advantages in terms of institutional relationships with the judges. They control all of the evidence, and the defense lawyers don't have the right to get all of the evidence. So there's an imbalance in the amount of evidence, including potentially exculpatory evidence, which doesn't always get to the defense. And then on the very end, they can appeal and sort of have another go with a higher court. So once the prosecutors have made a decision to prosecute you, you are almost certainly going to be convicted.
Are the Japanese proud of their system? Are they proud of this statistic? Does it indicate for them that the system is working well?
I think that a lot of Japanese people are of the view that if you've been arrested, you've probably done something wrong. And if you've been prosecuted, you've probably done something wrong. And, you know, that can almost become a self-reinforcing feedback loop, right? Well, everybody who's prosecuted, it turns out they did do something wrong because they were convicted. Where it becomes something that is, I think, newsworthy to the average Japanese person is when you start to get this news of the prolonged detention that Mr. Ghosn talked about, where people are locked up and effectively punished for weeks and weeks, question you in very harsh conditions before they even decide to prosecute you. And I think that is surprising to Japanese people when they learn it works that way. And I think that's part of what is surprising to people in England and the United States is the ability of prosecutors to effectively punish you without putting you on trial.
What happened to the idea of innocent until proven guilty? I mean, is that an idea that has any purchase in Japan?
Well, yes, it does. But, you know, the reality of the system is that there are a lot of presumptions of guilt built into the way the process of a criminal investigation or a criminal trial is operated. And you effectively get punished more severely for asserting your innocence.
So do you think Carlos Ghosn was rational in viewing his conviction as near certain, and therefore he just smuggled himself out of the country?
I have to be very clear, I really have no insights into his guilt or innocence, but if I was a betting person and I had to, you know, I was going to bet on the result, I want very high odds to bet against him being convicted.
Professor Colin Jones. So they do things differently in Japan. Or do they? What about Canada, where, according to Wikipedia, the conviction rate is 97%? I'm afraid Wikipedia has this one wrong.
The 97% conviction rate, I think, is a statistic that's derived from the fact that 3.6% of individuals are acquitted. But it doesn't mean that the other 97% are somehow convicted.
Kim Schofield is a criminal defense lawyer in Toronto.
That 97% conviction rate really is an error to just subtract the acquittals from the amount of charges laid.
We checked with Statistics Canada. They said they don't even keep figures for a conviction rate, but they do have some numbers that help. In 2017-18, 3.6% of criminal cases in adult court led to acquittal, as Kim Schofield says. But 62% ended in a guilty decision, and one-third were withdrawn or subject to a Crown stay.
A Crown stay is really a uniquely Canadian thing in that the Crown has the discretion to put on hold, essentially, a case for up to a year. So there's no other court appearances, so a stay is entered, and they have 1 year to reinvigorate that prosecution. I have never seen a case where the Crown decides to reinvigorate the prosecution, but they could. And then a withdrawal is just a straight withdrawal. It means all matters are withdrawn and it's akin to an acquittal.
So a third of all criminal cases are stayed or withdrawn, which, if you're the defendant, means you're free to go.
I think the most misleading thing about these statistics is the guilty rate, which is the 62%. That statistic takes into consideration guilty pleas, deals that are offered, lesser charges. But if you just go straight to trial, so there's no deals, there's no nothing, there's a relatively small percentage of matters that actually go for trial. And so then if you were to look at those who go to trial, what the acquittal versus conviction rates, and I'm a trial lawyer, and I always tell clients, even, you know, not knowing much about the case, statistically, it hovers around 50-50.
So, in Canada at least, if you are charged, it is often worth going to trial.
I always say that it's still worth a shot. The Crown has a tough burden. It's the same in the UK, which is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And, you know, our system, I think, is a good one. And it's not one that, on first blush, which is 3.6% of the people are acquitted. That, on its face, is a misleading statistic. It doesn't tell you the story at all.
Lawyer Kim Schofield speaking to us from Toronto. You're listening to More or Less. Now, I realise this may come as a surprise to some of you, but people on social media are arguing about Brexit. A headline in the New European magazine read,
Brexit already costing more than UK's net contributions to EU over 47 years.
Now, that's not true, according to the first sentence of the article underneath that headline, which claims that Brexit will cost more by the end of this year. But let's not split hairs. It is an interesting claim, which emerges from comparing two figures. One is an estimate by Bloomberg News of the damage done to the UK economy since the 2016 referendum vote. It says the cost was £130 billion by the end of 2019 and will reach £200 billion by the end of 2020. The second figure is the total net contribution to the EU budget from the UK, which, according to the House of Commons Library, adds up to £178 billion. Now, the second figure is pretty straightforward, but what about the first? How could we estimate the damage done by Brexit to the UK economy? And since Brexit hasn't happened yet, why should we think there's been any damage at all? I put these questions to an independent arbiter, the chief economist of the Institute for Government, Gemma Tetlow.
It's obviously a really important question. What impact has the vote for Brexit had on the UK economy? But it's an incredibly hard one to answer because it requires you to answer the question, what would have been the path of the UK economy since the summer of 2016 if we'd voted the other way?
It hasn't stopped people trying, though, has it?
It hasn't stopped people trying. I think it's right to try to answer this question, but it is difficult. And people have taken a few different approaches, and most of them boil down to trying to look to other countries around the world that in the past have grown in a similar way to the UK and say, if we thought that the UK growth path would have been more similar to those countries than what's actually happened in the UK in the way that it was in the past, over the past 3.5 years, how much larger might the UK economy now be than it actually is?
So in a nutshell, if we always grew in the past like Spain, say, I mean, that wouldn't be right, but if we always grew like Spain in the past and then suddenly after the vote, we stopped growing like Spain, we started growing more slowly than Spain, maybe that's because of the vote. I mean, that would be an oversimplification, but that's the gist.
That's the gist of it.
Okay.
And the Bloomberg exercise was precisely along those lines to look at the other major economies in the world, the other G7 economies.
So the UK's always grown in the past like the G7 average or like some modified version of the G7 average?
So my understanding of what Bloomberg did is that they took some sort of weighted average of the G7 that most closely matched the UK growth performance.
All right, so it's like 8% Italy, 12% US, 5% Japan or something. You mix them all up.
Mix them all up and you can plot something that looks very similar to UK growth performance up to the summer of 2016. And then if you look at the growth path of that mixture of G7 economies beyond 2016 and compare that to what's actually happened in the UK, then the Bloomberg figures suggest that by the end of this year, the UK economy would be 3% smaller than it would have been had the UK continued to perform in the same way it used to relative to the G7.
Right. So, and if you add up the 3% of GDP this year and it would be 2% last year and 1% the year before, whatever, total all that and it's 200 billion.
That's correct.
So do you find that kind of approach persuasive?
I think it's reasonably persuasive. There are a number of different ways that you could try to approach this, and other people have used different methods. So, for example, looking at how the growth forecasts for different economies have been downgraded from before the vote to after the vote. And you can see that people have become much more pessimistic about UK growth prospects and the outturns have been worse relative to what we expected in early 2016 than is the case for other countries.
So the UK has disappointed relative to expectations and those expectations set before the referendum.
That's right. And the UK has disappointed to a greater extent than other economies around the world are. So suggesting there is something uniquely problematic for the UK that other countries haven't seen. So there are a few different ways you could look at it, and all of them come up with broadly similar answers to the question. So perhaps somewhere between 2 and 3% less economic output in the UK than you would have expected had the vote gone the other way in summer 2016.
Okay, so that's the sort of data that suggests that maybe the Brexit vote damaged the UK economy. I'm sure people will reach their own conclusions as to whether they find that persuasive. Just in theory, why might the Brexit vote have damaged the UK economy, given that we have not left yet?
That's a very good point. Nothing has changed substantively in our trading relationship with the EU. So the major thing that has happened is we have uncertainty about what's going to happen in the future. And there's perhaps been particular uncertainty for businesses who have held off from making any investment decisions. So even if you believe that the UK economy is, say, 3% smaller than it would have been had we voted to remain in June 2016, that still doesn't really answer the question of what's the ultimate impact of the Brexit vote going to be.
I mean, will we ever know? Could we be having this conversation in 10 years' time you'll obviously look the same. I'll have lost all my hair by then. And looking back on the last 10 years of endless Brexit negotiations, probably, will we at that point be able to know what the impact was? Or will we still be arguing?
We will still be arguing. We will never be able to answer the question of exactly what would have happened to the UK if we hadn't left the EU. And in fact, I think it will get increasingly hard to answer that question because, as I said, most of the methods to try and estimate what the difference in growth performance has been so far rely on either looking at the performance of other countries, which the UK was similar to before 2016, or comparing forecasts from before 2016 to what's happened since. And both of those methods, I think, become increasingly ropey the longer time goes on, because so much else is happening in the world and in those other countries that it makes it increasingly hard to try and identify something that looked like the UK would have done.
Gemma Tetlow of the Institute for Government. Now, on to the issues that really matter. Deep Singh sent the following question to More or Less at bbc.co.uk.
In a small booklet about the plants and animals in Florida, I read an alligator with its tail off the ground can run as fast as 30 miles per hour, which translates to about 13.4 meters per second, about 30% faster than someone like Usain Bolt. Can this be possible?
What you got going is the alligator stroll. Okay.
Well, I know that you should never smile at a crocodile, but I don't know whether an alligator is a great perambulator, so we called in an expert, John Hutchinson, Professor of Evolutionary Biomechanics at the Royal Veterinary College's Structure and Motion Laboratory. Hello, John.
Hello.
So you've been in Florida racing alligators and crocodiles?
Yes, I have. I've spent quite a bit of time there studying their movement.
So when you say studying their movement, what does that actually involve?
Well, we built a very simple sort of racetrack, just about 5 meters long and a meter or so wide, and let various crocodilians go at one end and coax them to go toward the other end.
How do you coax a crocodile or an alligator?
Sometimes you just let them go and they go away from you because they don't like you. Other times you have to poke them with the blunt end of a broom or something.
I would just have imagined hamburgers at the other end, but does that not work as a motivator?
No. A challenge was that we had to tape their jaws shut with electrical tape for everyone's safety, including theirs.
Right.
So food was not a motivator for them.
Right. So I am now imagining crocodiles and alligators with their mouths duct taped shut, being prodded by brooms and sprinting along a 5 meter track, which is not very long, right? 100 meter sprint in the Olympics is 20 times further, but still you measure their speed over this short distance. So how fast can they run? 30 miles an hour, 50 kilometers an hour is what this textbook says?
I'm afraid not. Not even on a good day. That's faster than most land animals. We found that the fastest crocodilians, whether they were alligators or crocodiles, could all reach about the same top speed, which was no more than about 11 miles per hour or so, 18 kilometers an hour.
Feels like a fair clip, but it's nowhere near 50 kilometers an hour, which is not surprising because they've got little legs. They've got little legs and big tummies. I mean, how could they run it 50 kilometers an hour?
They do have quite short, stubby legs and a lot of weight to carry around, and they're just not really adapted for sustained land locomotion.
See you later, alligator. After a while, crocodile.
Liverpool FC is hard as hell. United, Tottenham, Arsenal.
We need to talk about Liverpool.
Watch my lips, and I will spell, because they don't just play, but they can rap as well.
They just keep winning, not merely avoiding defeat, but winning. In the last 21 league games, as of Friday the 17th of January, they have lost 0, drawn 1, and won 20. It's the best opening run in the history, not just of the top English league, but across the other leading European leagues in France, Germany, Italy, and Spain. It is an astonishing performance. But such an extraordinary record requires not only skill, but a bit of luck from time to time. Over the last few years, there has been a revolution in football statistics. In the old days, we just counted the goals. Then we started to count shots on target. Now sports data companies are measuring much more than that. A shot from 30 yards is very unlikely to go in, but one from just a couple of yards is highly likely to result in a goal. So a new metric was developed to take account of the quality of shots, and that metric is known as expected goals. Jake Osgathorpe is an analyst for InfoGoal, an app that crunches the football numbers. Starting with the expected goals metric, he has been running thousands and thousands of simulations to evaluate Liverpool's results for us and whether they're winning more games than the flow of play would suggest.
Based on Liverpool's performances, looking at the expected goals in the games, they've got 61 points this season, which is a staggering number. And based on our simulations of the chances in the games and the games, the results that they should have got in the games, we did 10,000 sims and we didn't get to any. We were unable to land on their current point total of 61. The best that we could come up with, or that we would have expected from Liverpool, is 18 wins and 3 draws from their 21 games. And that would only be likely in one in 800 seasons, showing just how fortunate they are to be 20 wins and 1 draw at this stage.
Yeah. So you did 10,000 simulations. In the very best of the 10,000, you get 18 wins, 3 draws. They've actually got 20 wins, 1 draw. What's the best way to describe that? Is that Liverpool were lucky, that Liverpool's opponents were unlucky, or they're just brilliant, but it's brilliant in an unquantifiable way?
It's probably a bit of both. I think Liverpool this season have seen a lot of positive variance.
They've outperformed expectations.
Yes, exactly. And one of the main things that we look at is the fact that 10 of the wins have come by a 1-goal margin. And any other season, that sort of number, it's quite a high number. Half of the wins have been by a 1-goal margin.
And then you're just one slip, one fluke away from a draw.
Exactly. So they've basically been, when they've been in that position, they've been fortunate perhaps not to concede. I mean, the example last weekend against Tottenham, when Giovanni Lo Celso missed that huge chance towards the end of the game. If he scores that, then we're looking at this slightly differently.
Yeah.
And arguably Spurs did deserve a draw based on expected goals, because that was the best chance in the game. So little small things like that have gone Liverpool's way at crucial times this season.
Purely on the expected goals metric, would Liverpool at this stage be leading the league, or would it be Leicester or Manchester City?
No, it would be Manchester City. They have been the...
Ooh, this is controversial stuff. So City would actually be ahead on expected goals?
Yes.
I have to say, I don't follow the football that closely, but they are not close to Liverpool.
No.
They are not remotely close to Liverpool in the actual table.
That's right. And what we're seeing, while Liverpool have been very fortunate in their results, being 61 points after 21 games, Manchester City are really unfortunate to be sat 14 points back of Liverpool at this stage. They should be a lot closer, and we should actually have a real title challenge on our hands.
You would actually say, based on the underlying performance of the teams, the underlying performance of the attack and the defence, you would expect Manchester City to maybe outscore Liverpool. But there's no way they're going to win the title, is there?
No. I think after the win against Tottenham last weekend is literally 98% Liverpool, 2% Manchester City.
Now, I should just say, this programme is broadcast on Friday afternoon, but our repeat is broadcast on Sunday evening, just a couple of hours after Liverpool's match against Manchester United. Just in case Liverpool lost that match 3-0 to Manchester United, would you like now to apologise to Liverpool fans for jinxing the team?
No, even if they lose to Manchester United, I'm pretty sure they'll win the title.
Jake Osgathorpe of InfoGoal. That is all we have time for this week, but if you have any questions, comments, or hard luck football stories for us, please get in touch. We are at moreorless@bbc.co.uk. We will be back next week. Until then, goodbye.
Word. That's unbelievable, it really is. I think they should stick to playing football. What do you think, Kenny?
Oh, yeah!
More or Less was produced in partnership with the Open University.